Genesis 45, 1 to 15. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from here." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither ploughing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and their flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honour in Egypt, and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here." Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. In Genesis 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive, as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them.
Thanks, Dave. It's a very odd way to end the story of Joseph, this. I mean, here in chapter 50, right at the end of the book of Genesis, what do we find? 17 years after the events of chapter 45, he has to reassure his brothers all over again that he really does forgive them. And they, the great ancestors of Israel, we look at them and we find them shivering in their boots and lying through their teeth. Not only do they lie, but they lie about their father's last will and testament in order to give their lie a little bit more leverage with dear old Joseph. Now, I am sure these dark intrigues were not in the Bible last time I looked. But you look at this. Chapter 50, verse 15, printed there. Jacob, their father, has just died. And now they are worried, with him out of the way, now it will be payback time. That with their father out of the way, there is nothing left to stop Joseph from taking the revenge that he's been waiting for all these years, and for throwing him down that hole in the ground all those years ago and selling him as a slave. And you know, the brothers are so afraid of Joseph's vengeance, they cannot even face him. Now, you know, like I know, that if you're going to say a thing like verse 16, if you're going to say something that important, and you're really serious about it, you say it face to face, don't you? You don't hide behind a telephone or an email or a text message or something like that. But then you look at the brothers in verse 16, they send him an email, not message. Your father gave this command before he died. Now, Joseph's father gave no command of the sort. You can check out Joseph's father's last words. They are recorded at enormous length in the chapters in between these two. Chapter 48 and 49, you have the last will and testament of Jacob, the forefather of Israel. And something as important as verse 17 is not going to be missing from the documents there. Never mention. This bit in verse 17, this bit of last will and testament is a forged document. The prosecution lawyers are going to have it for breakfast. The very last words that we get from these brothers are more porkies of the patriarchs, more deceptions, a big black get me off the hook lie. And we as people who've read as far as chapter 50, we're supposed to have spotted that. So what are we supposed to do with the end of this long, complicated story of Joseph? Do we look at it and say, well, fibs are okay in a good cause because the forefathers did it. It's in the Bible. Do we say, wasn't Joseph a nice chap because he forgave his brothers even after everything that they did to him? Do we look at verse 20? Do we look at verse 20 and we say alongside Joseph that what his brothers did to him, they intended for evil, they wanted to do harm, they had bad things in mind for Joseph, but in the great plan of God, God was able to turn it around for good, even though their intentions were evil. I mean, that's an important thing, isn't it? It's a rather mind-blowing thing, really. And over the last few weeks, as we have walked through these stories of Joseph in a slightly strange way, various people have pointed out to me that they have expected me to bring this one up. That so clearly in the story of Joseph, even though the brothers try to destroy him, and he winds up a slave, and he winds up in prison under false charges, and even through all these terrible things, God still works things out to bring good. Now, that is definitely there in Genesis, isn't it? I entirely agree with everyone who has pointed that out to me over the last 3 weeks. It's quite true. And we need to know that every day, don't we? We need to know that every day when bad things happen. But hey, if we already believe that, then I'm not going to spend time making a song and dance about it. Of course God can bring good out of evil. You think about it. In a dark and nasty world like this one, what else is there for him to work with? If there is going to be good, God has to bring it out of evil. From the gospel, we ought to be thoroughly used to the idea of God bringing good out of extreme evil. You think, crucifying Jesus. Was that evil? Oh yeah. You do not get nastier than that. What did God do with it? Only brought the ultimate salvation for the human race and eternal life and forgiveness. But you take that comparison between Jesus and Joseph. Hold that in the frame for a while. Because I think there are some other things here for us as well as the clear message that God can bring good out of what people intend for evil. What do I mean? Well, look at these two chapters, 5 chapters and 17 years apart from each other. Now, that figure of 17 years, by the way, comes from chapter 47, verse 28. If you're taking notes, chapter 47, verse 28, you can look it up later and see whether I've worked this out right. But Joseph's assertion that they meant it for evil, but all the time God was intending to save people, why does he have to make it there in chapter 45? You see it there in verse 5, God sent me before you to preserve life. And then he has to make the same statement all over again 17 years later in chapter 50, down in verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be saved. Why does he have to do that again so far apart? I mean, if he had the big tear-jerking reconciliation with the brothers back in chapter 45, if that worked, why are they still so nervous 17 years later in chapter 50? When they have been in Egypt all those years, they've been looked after by brother Joseph, they've lived on the fat of the land for 17 years, and by the time you get to chapter 50, it is now nearly 40 years after the thing that they did that was so bad. I mean, you think about it, 40 years. How many things that you did in the late 1960s? How many people here were around in the late 1960s, let alone doing things that give them a bad conscience? Yeah, think about it. If you did something way back in 1968, would you still be racked with guilt about it? So racked with guilt that you are prepared to lie to get yourself off the hook 40 years later. There is some very serious guilt going on here in chapter 50 that is still not out of the way. See, how does the reconciliation, the big reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers, how does that work out? Chapter 45 that we read is just the final act in a long and complex process. But you remember how the story goes. Way back, chapter 37, with Joseph as a lad of 17 and a favourite son of his father, these brothers had seized the moment to get rid of him. Far from civilization, they'd pulled off Joseph's robe, they'd thrown him down a hole, and then they debated with each other, should we sell him, should we kill him? Should we sell him, should we kill him? They decided to sell him. He's sold off into the sunset as a slave. His robe, torn and stained with blood, is taken back to Jacob, his father, as evidence that he's been mauled by wild beasts. And from there, things for poor old Joseph go further and further downhill. Joseph is sold in Egypt. He is lied about by Potiphar's wife. He is jailed for doing the very thing that he had refused to do. Only the continual notes as we read in the book of Genesis, the Lord was with Joseph, the Lord was with Joseph. That and his effectiveness as a slave and his effectiveness as a prisoner. Imagine if your greatest achievement in life is to be effective as a prisoner, to be a very good prisoner. Only those few little insights give us any indication that God is working anything other than complete disaster for Joseph out of all of this. But even when he's in prison, he appeals to one of the other prisoners who is going to get released. When you are released, put my case. I am innocent. Please plead for me. The guy gets released and forgets all about Joseph. Not until Pharaoh dreams his dreams in chapter 41 does Joseph's life change. And suddenly he goes from prison cell to the grand wazir of all Egypt. That was the word, wasn't it, David? No? It wasn't wazir. David said that I'd used a word this morning that was obscure and didn't make... Wazir, Prime Minister of Egypt, big guy, government official. Not to worry. You can wave a limb in the air if I get to the word. But he's the grand wazir of all Egypt. And it's an Arabic word, isn't it? And he is father to Pharaoh. You see it there in verse 8 of chapter 45. God has made me like a father to Pharaoh. Then comes the complicated bit. from chapter 42 onwards, the story narrows. And we see three trips that Joseph's brothers make from Canaan down to Egypt.
Here they are in the land of Canaan, the surviving brothers.
And in chapter 42, we get that marvellous bit where Jacob, the father, says to the brothers, "Why do you sit there looking at each other? Behold, there is grain for sale in Egypt." And he sends them off, all except Benjamin, the youngest, who is his new favourite son. Now, when we read it, and the brothers go on their journey to Egypt, we know what they don't. That it's little brother Joseph that they will have to deal with when they get to Egypt. But 20 years have gone by, 21 years have gone by since they dropped him down that hole. They turn up in Egypt as hairy shepherds from Canaan. They're 20 years older. Joseph is all done up in gold and linen and prancing around as the top man in Egypt. Of course they do not recognize him. They think he's an Egyptian. But in chapter 42, verse 7, he recognizes them. But he doesn't let on. In chapter 42, verse 7, we read, "He treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them." And we discover later that to add to the deception, when Joseph speaks to his brothers, he speaks to them in Egyptian through an interpreter and pretends not to understand their language while all the time he's listening to everything that they say. Now, we saw last time with the Pharaoh and his dreams and the economic pillage of Egypt that Joseph carries out, that this Joseph, he's the kind of guy who can come up with very complex and very subtle schemes very quickly. His mind is on the ball here, and he seems to do that here. In chapter 42, he accuses his brothers of spying, and he gives them 3 days in the cells. When he lets them out, he keeps his brother Simeon in custody, and he sends the rest back to Canaan with instructions that if they ever return, they must bring little brother Benjamin with them. That is the only condition on which they can come back. And as a final refinement, the money that they had paid in Egypt to buy food, he has planted inside the packages of food that they take back to Canaan. They don't discover this until they're on the way. What are we doing with this money? We thought we'd spent it. What is going on? The brothers are seriously spooked. Back in Canaan, they break the news to Jacob that they've had to leave Simeon behind in Egypt, and they dare never return unless they bring young Benjamin with them. And for a good year, Jacob refuses to let them go. "I've lost Joseph, I've lost Simeon, I'm not having you lose Benjamin for me as well." Only in chapter 43, when the food runs out, and Judah, brother Judah, shoulders the responsibility, "I will look after Benjamin and make sure he comes to no harm," only then does Jacob allow a return visit to Egypt. So they go back, taking Benjamin with them. Now, chapters 43 and 44, when you read them, are enormously complex and full of intrigues and complicated game playing by Joseph that I will not even try to summarize. You just have to read it. If we were worried about the brothers contriving a whopper in verse 16 of chapter 50 here, if we were worried by that, we will even be more worried by the strange web of lies and deception that Joseph spins in chapters 43 and 44. But even with Benjamin there, Joseph still doesn't reveal himself. Instead, he arranges a complicated scheme where a valuable piece of silverware is hidden inside Benjamin's luggage. And then Benjamin gets caught, his luggage is opened up, they find this thing, and he gets framed for theft and jailed. At the climax of chapter 44, it is Judah, who is the very brother who originally hatched the plan to sell Joseph, It is Judah who now pleads with Joseph, punish me, not Benjamin. Jail me, not Benjamin. And he appeals to the effect that losing Benjamin will have on their father Jacob. And it's only then, it's only after Judah's impassioned speech that we get Joseph's passionate response in verse 1 here. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. And he wept aloud, and Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. And then, after all the manipulation and after chapters of deception, then comes the reconciliation of verse 14. At the climax of this fantastically moving chapter, he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. But what are we to say about the way it happens? This long chess game that Joseph plays with his brother's emotions, messing around with what's inside them. If we place
the worst possible construction on it.
Look at it the worst possible way. Joseph is playing a series of cruel jokes on his brothers in which he manages to pay them back in guilt for what they did to him. The money in the luggage, the time in the prison, the accusations of spying, and then finally framing Benjamin for theft. Is it all a twisted kind of revenge? Make them suffer like he suffered before he is prepared to be friends with them again. Is that what's going on? I don't think that's right. I don't think that is what's going on. We saw last week in his dealings with the Egyptians that Joseph is deep. He is capable of some pretty subtle manoeuvring. But I don't think he is malicious that way to play cat and mouse with them for so long with cruel intent. But if we don't look too darkly at Joseph, if we place the best possible construction on what he's doing, what have we got? Joseph sets up a kind of obstacle course for his brothers. We've got Joseph laying certain tests in front of his brothers, where they have to show, by what they do and how they overcome the tests, that they really have changed. They must show that they truly repent before there can be reconciliation. So he wants to set up a situation where they have the opportunity to drop brother Benjamin down the hole the same as they did to him all those years ago. Joseph sets that up to see what will happen. And only when he sees that Judah will put himself on the line rather than let anything happen to Benjamin, only when he is convinced that the brothers have really changed, is he prepared to tell them who he is and to be reconciled to them. They might read it that way, and we think about it that way, and we sort of nod sagely, and we think, yeah, that's all right. That's all right. There has to be repentance for there to be real reconciliation and trust. I mean, it might be all very well welcoming back the prodigal son and putting a ring on his finger and bells on his toes and killing the fatted calf and saying, unconditional forgiveness, reconciliation is yours. But when your husband finally leaves his girlfriend and comes back with a box of chocolates and a bunch of roses and says very, very sorry for the fifth time since the month of March, are you going to kill the fatted calf or put him in the garden shed on probation until he proves that he's changed? We know in relationships that to be reconciled we need a bit of trust. We need an assurance that the person we're dealing with is being straight with us. And in a way, we can see Joseph kind of doing that in this cat and mouse thing with his brothers. Before he finally comes out and announces in verse 5, do not be distressed for yourselves, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Okay, we can sort of see that sort of thing going on. But who gave Joseph the right to play cat and mouse like that? Who gave him the right to hold it over them from such a very great height? Who gave him the right to hold out on them until he was so jolly sure of them? It's also paternalistic. And maybe this is a matter of taste, but I think Joseph comes out like one of those professional personality tests that they run on you when you fill in a job application. You apply for the job and they say, fill out this questionnaire. And it has all these bizarre questions. You know, would you prefer to spend the evening watching football with your friends or going out to a concert at the Opera House? And what on earth is this all about? It's sort of, let me diagnose you and tell you your strengths and your weaknesses. And you say, on what basis? On what marvellous and objective theoretical grounds are you going to stand up and take the high ground and pontificate about me and who I am? Or the sleazy senior management types who will do your annual performance review and ask a few theoretical questions about your taste in music and then use it to draw conclusions about your ability to add up columns of figures. They fill in the boxes with their pencil, and you get grumpier and grumpier about this, and they say, aye, this one's got a high obstructiveness index and a low cooperative capacity when it comes to working with those in authority. You know, of course you come out that way when they're doing your annual performance review. If you think I'm over the top with this, catch this. Back in chapter 42, when Joseph was pretending to be an Egyptian, he listened in to his brother's conversation while they were saying, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. But that's earlier. Before he even locks up Simeon and sends them back to Canaan the first time around, Joseph already knows they are deeply in guilt over what they did to him. But from his position of great superiority, he still plays around with them and lays these tests on them before coming out and making friends. And see how unsatisfactory the result is. In chapter 45, we have the big reconciliation scene, but in chapter 50, the brothers are still not sure whether they're really forgiven or not. Are we forgiven? Or is he still out to get us? This is reconciliation, but it's a bit dark, isn't it? Deception on one side, suspicion on the other, and always the dark doubt. Are we really forgiven? Will he still take some kind of revenge? But the thing is, for all the fact that they are never sure whether Joseph really forgives them or not, this story is the absolute premier reconciliation story of the Old Testament. You think about it. The Old Testament is full of wars and feuds and fallings out and precious few makings up, but this is the most successful. The only reconciliation that comes anywhere near this one is between Jacob and his hairy brother Esau back in chapter 33, where they kiss and make up on a grand scale. But in that one, if we remember the story, Jacob lies to his brother about his intentions, and he gets away and out of his brother's land as quickly as possible for fear of what will happen. And what stands between them is more like a kind of an armed truce of a Cold War than any kind of real friendship. This suspicious standoff Joseph and his brothers have is, it's better than that, but how much better? But if it's the best the Old Testament has to offer, really drives us on to the New Testament looking for something more. Because surely there has to be a better way for people to get on than this paternalism on one side and suspicion on the other. There's got to be a better way of being human than that. See, I've already mentioned the comparison between Joseph and Jesus, that both of them brought salvation through evil circumstances. Verse 5, God sent me before you to preserve life. Joseph saves people from the famine. Jesus saves people for eternity. But think of Jesus and reconciliation too, and compare him to Joseph. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians in the New Testament, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. With Jesus and reconciliation, we are the people who come onto the stage in the position of Joseph's brothers. That's who we are in the Jesus story. We were the people who let him down, who ignored him, who treated him like nothing. But he gave himself to reconcile us. But then, you think about that. When Jesus does that, what hoops does Jesus demand that we jump through before we can be reconciled? What ordeals do we have to go through before he gives us forgiveness and lets us back into the family? How much do we have to do to prove that we have really changed before he will forgive us? See the difference between Joseph and Jesus? Even if we place the best possible construction on Joseph, that he is testing these brothers to watch them prove that they have truly changed, that is very different from Jesus, who calls us to turn around and trust him, and then helps us to change. Joseph wants the brothers to prove themselves. Jesus holds out reconciliation as a gift and calls only for trust and helps us to make a new life. But that doesn't just affect things between us and God. It spills over into the way we treat each other too. See, in the New Testament, what is the great principle for how we treat each other? It's how Jesus treated us. See, you take an example, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Paul is writing about the kinds of love that we are supposed to show each other. What does he say? Patient, kind, not envious, not boastful, and so on. The way that Jesus has been to us. Or in Colossians chapter 3, when Paul writes, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is. And then he goes on with the things that characterize Christ and should characterize his people until he gets to these words. Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassion, kindness, humility, meekness and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. You think, oh dear, is that what we've got to be? Ouch, that hurts. You know, I much prefer the Joseph method when I am the one doing the forgiving. Make them sweat a bit. Make them prove that they are really sorry and they won't do it again. Hold it over them a bit. But no, the New Testament has a better way to treat you the way Christ has treated me. Now, I can't be high and mighty with that, can I? I can't take the high ground and be all superior while I test whether you have repented properly according to my exacting standards. But with Jesus, there is no going over the ground again 17 years later. Did he really forgive me, or was he just kidding? You trust Jesus. He really forgives you. And for us, that is the pattern as well. Penance is a thing that has no place in Christian fellowship. You know, having to do something to work off your guilt and make it okay has no place in Christian fellowship. Neither does revenge. Neither does even keeping a snide little grudge. Joseph comes out in the Old Testament as a great man. And he really is. He is great. He is one of the top people in the Old Testament. But in the end, He's Old Testament man. He's man outside the garden. He's part of the problem. And reading the story of Joseph, we see God at work, but with Joseph, we see even a great man who holds out reconciliation to brothers who treated him so badly. Even with all of that, he's unsatisfied. He drives us on to look for a man who is not part of the problem, to look for a better reconciliation, to look for the man who says, "Father, forgive them," even when they are doing their worst to him. The story of Joseph, it's a signpost on the way to Jesus. And with Jesus, we get the reconciliation we need. And with Jesus, we get the real pattern, the earth-shaking pattern, for how to be really reconciled with each other.